Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Progressive American. I'm Connor, back with another morning podcast about the news from a progressive perspective. Welcome back to the show. It is Saturday, December 4th, 2021. Today we are talking about the Trumpist influence on elections, Ghislaine Maxwell's trial, the Omicron variant, and Chris Cuomo getting suspended from CNN. With that out of the way, let's get into the news. As many of you are already aware, I have been warning about the consistent efforts by Republicans to reshape the election system, both in my writing and on this show. However, with the midterms less than a year away, Republican attempts to rewrite elections and to put their own people in positions of power take on special importance, and with redistricting in process, the consequences couldn't be more influential on our republic. The Washington Post reported on Monday, November 29th, that Trump is using his endorsements to increase his influence over state elections, whether it is attempting to endorse new candidates for secretaries of state, or it is directed at removing anti-Trump allies from positions of power. Indeed, state GOP operatives have moved out in force, attempting to alter the paths of power across the United States. In Michigan, the local GOP is attempting to reshape election canvassing boards. They are doing this by appointing members who supported the idea that the 2020 election was rigged. Pennsylvania has also seen a similar trend, with two communities electing pro-Trump activists who believe that the election was stolen to positions of power as voting judges and inspectors. Trumpist allies are also working to remove previous local officials and replace them with loyalists. They are doing this by targeting poll watchers, precinct judges, and much more to ensure that they control the results in elections in the future. These figures are of particular concern to officials who see the continued efforts to blame fraud for Republican defeats as a threat to future elections and their integrity. In an interview with the Washington Post, Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold warned that this new movement was seeking to take control over elections across the board, saying, "The attacks right now are no longer about 2020. They're about 2022 and 2024. It's about chipping away at confidence and chipping away at the reality of safe and secure elections. And the next time there's a close election, it'll be easier to achieve their goals. That is what this is all about." To further prove this point, Christina Karomo, the GOP candidate for Michigan's Secretary of State, has routinely embraced revisiting the 2020 election's validity, arguing that a so-called forensic audit of the election is necessary. Karomo has also made unsupported claims that she witnessed fraud during the 2020 election as a poll challenger. This comes as Michigan has become the epicenter of GOP efforts to control local elections all the way down to canvassers. The argument for this approach to elections falls flat on its face when considering the fact that the Michigan GOP's own report found that there was no fraud that impacted Michigan's election results or in any way altered the course of the election. And make no mistake, the efforts by the GOP are an inevitable part of their historic reaction to their loss of public support. It is a reaction to the massive amount of voter turnout we saw in 2020 that reached historic levels, something we have not seen in years. And to some extent, it reveals their anti-democratic principles. Behind all their claims to respect the Constitution and the rights of the people, they are not willing to allow a free and a fair election so long as they are the losers. Ultimately, Republicans are trying to protect their chances at holding on to power irrespective of what the people want. It is of the utmost importance now that Congress passes stronger regulations to protect voter rights. But if Republicans are given the chance to continue on their current path, as I'm sure they will change the rules to ensure that their election in the future is almost guaranteed. No matter what they do to the people, no matter how much they violate their rights, their dignity, and their well-being, they will hold on to power with an iron grip. It's time to start pushing Congress to prevent that from happening before we endure a nightmare. In similar news, Trump and his allies have begun working to remove previously tolerated opponents from power through primary challenges, but the candidates endorsed by Trump also reflect a more dangerous tone in politics. According to Ballotopedia, Donald Trump has endorsed nearly 36 candidates in elections across the United States. Of the people he has endorsed, Trump has a personal or professional connection with 13 of them, and almost every single endorsement is directed at removing anti-Trump Republicans from their positions. Six of his endorsed candidates are challenging Republicans who voted for his impeachment. In other words, Trump is expanding his influence over the party and all the institutions that it controls. But Trump's brand of politics comes with a consequence that I don't think they're quite ready for, or at the very least, they haven't quite refined. Part of the issue is that having men loyal to Trump in more positions of power is that they bring conspiracies and violence with them. Three of the people he endorsed, Representative Mo Brooks, Congressional candidate Derek Von Orden, and Arizona Secretary of State candidate Mark Finchem, have all been involved in some way, shape, or form with the January 6th insurrection. For example, Brooks spoke at the insurrection, propping up the lie that there was a massive amount of voter fraud that changed the election's results, legitimizing the lie over and over again, and in doing so, demonizing the Democratic Party as illegitimate. Finchem, however, was more connected to the organizers of the rally than any of them, directly communicating with Ali Alexander, who helped prepare the rally outside the Capitol. Alexander is notorious for posting violent imagery, despite his previously stated apprehensions about what happened at the Capitol on January 6, according to Reuters. And it isn't just a handful of Trumpists that are parroting odd and dangerous conspiracy theories. Representative Ronnie Jackson of Texas has claimed recently that the emerging Omicron variant is a Democratic plot to push mail-in ballots and steal the election. And I imagine he presumes that the last election was stolen as well. For obvious reasons, this is nonsense. Omicron's origins are unknown, and it is still unclear how dangerous it is actually going to be. It would make no sense to depend upon a virus that we know little about to steal an election, and it would be incredibly difficult to do in the first place. But if you tried to explain that to him, I doubt he'd listen. And this is the problem with the current shift within the Republican Party. They are growing merely beyond hyper-fixating on abortion or opposing any sort of social spending. They are hyper-focusing on demonization and conspiracy theories so they can convince people that the Democrats are so fundamentally evil that they are not fit to govern, no matter how popular their policies are. And I can imagine some conservatives are upset with my prognosis here, arguing that we should be more bipartisan and fair. But one of the major parties is actively seeking to delegitimize their opposition as inherently evil. And when that happens, bipartisanship becomes impossible. So long as Republicans see their current approach as fortuitous, they will continue indefinitely. And if activists don't find a way to push back and prevent their victory in future elections, they will have no incentive to stop. And that's going to be incredibly harmful to our democracy, if not bringing about its fall. In some good news, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy may be on his way out, as President Biden has begun making moves to remove the controversial official from his position. The Chicago Sun-Times is reporting that Biden is eyeing to replace two of the members of the Postal Service's Board of Governors. If they are approved, Biden will have secured enough votes on the board to remove DeJoy. The move has come as DeJoy has faced intense scrutiny for his conflicts of interest and previous business dealings. But more than that, DeJoy's reactions to the issues that are being faced at the Postal Service have made him wildly unpopular. More specifically, his attempts to cut costs at the Postal Service have also contributed to significant slowdowns in their ability to deliver to people. And that's a problem not just in terms of getting your everyday package delivered to your house or mail, but it also contributes to people not getting their medication through the mail should they need it. And that has real harms on everyday people, something that DeJoy seems unwilling to admit. Indeed, when DeJoy was first facing criticisms for his actions, he blatantly said that he would be there for a long time and that people should, quote, get used to him. And that was his attitude to the criticism throughout most of his time there thus far. So if the Biden administration can actually get this done and get two more sympathetic governors on the board, then I'm all for it. DeJoy's continued disregard for the consequences of his policymaking and the consequences of his own nepotistic and corrupt policies show that there is no reason to have him in such a position of power. Now, DeJoy himself does not make a lot of headlines except when he opens his mouth, but he does represent a fundamental problem with some of our government agencies. A lot of times, people who have no business serving the public actively work against their interests while claiming to fight for them. And DeJoy is just a perfect example of that. So long as people like DeJoy can continue to get away with keeping their positions and are insulated from the consequences of their actions, they will continue to act recklessly with disregard for the public. And until they are removed like DeJoy, they will continue to be a problem for people. So I hope to see the Biden administration actually follow through with this and see DeJoy removed from the position that he should never have had. In more disturbing news, we turn to the trial of Ghislaine Maxwell, the infamous right-hand woman to infamous pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Maxwell is accused of luring young women and girls to have sex with Epstein against their will. Lawyers for Maxwell argue that she is being used as a scapegoat for Epstein's crimes. However, with the testimony of Epstein's pilot and the upcoming testimony of several other women abused by Epstein and Maxwell, it is unlikely that she will be able to avoid some degree of responsibility. Though whether or not she will actually receive the full justice of the law is unclear. The prosecution is hoping to draw upon the testimony of four key witnesses, with one woman known as Jane coming forward to document how Maxwell would lure girls in. Jane met Maxwell and Epstein in 1994, per the prosecutor, and eventually would end up living with them despite being a teenager. While defendants may argue that Epstein is the one responsible, the fact that Maxwell played a role in Jane's relationship with Epstein speaks to the interconnected reality of Maxwell and Epstein's operation. Additionally, Maxwell and her lawyers have seemingly managed to avoid allowing pictures that Maxwell herself took of her victims from being entered into the court records. This is how far they're willing to go. There are clear documented pieces of evidence that Maxwell knew about what was going on and partook in it, and instead, the court is not allowing that evidence to be brought in to the record. And I would like to add that as much as Maxwell definitely deserves the criticism she receives, and a life in prison if not more, she's not the only one who deserves to be condemned. There are a lot of people who were on this plane that we still don't know about. There are a lot of people in power who just got revealed to be involved. Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew were well known to be on this plane, but now with the testimony of Epstein's pilot, we also know that Donald Trump was on that plane as well. And this is all part of the disgusting displays of powerful people accepting open pedophilia and how that speaks to our society as a whole. We have two former presidents under sworn testimony being on that plane at least once. We know two former presidents and a prince of a royal family was involved in a massive amount of pedophilia and exploitation of children. And yet this story is buried on cable and is almost always used as an example of one side of the political spectrum or another being evil, when that's not the point at all. Say what you will about my commentary earlier in this episode. When it comes to something like this, partisanship is not useful. This is something that reflects a fundamental failure of our society to deal with predators and to adequately keep people who abuse their power from any position that they could misuse. I don't know what's going to happen with Maxwell. I know that she deserves a lot more coverage and a lot more criticism, as well as just much more resources to investigate her. But when it comes to how we as a society have reacted to this, we have either reacted to it with conspiracy theories, ignorance, or partisanship, when in reality, this was allowed to go on for years, and Maxwell was just one part in it. We have a systemic failure to deal with predators, and unless we are willing to admit that, we are never going to prevent something like this from happening again. It's going to keep happening, and it probably is happening. I'm not saying, like, the government is controlled by satanic pedophiles or whatever QAnon says. But in terms of actually holding real predators accountable, our legal system only scratches the surface. Serious reforms need to be made. And speaking of people who are trying to avoid justice, we now turn towards Steve Bannon. Viewers from my previous episode will remember that Bannon was indicted and arrested for contempt of Congress due to his refusal to comply with a congressional subpoena to testify before the January 6th Commission. Now that he's been charged, Bannon is fighting back and is trying to avoid receiving the consequences of his actions through his usual method, stirring up the pot. Talking Points memo reported that the Justice Department has grown tired of Bannon and his attempts to fight in the court of public opinion, accusing him of trying to manipulate the court's proceedings with bogus attempts and requests to have documents released to the public. In their 10-page complaint against Bannon, the DOJ explained that, quote, "The defense's misleading claims, failure to confer, unexplained wholesale opposition, and extrajudicial statements make clear the defense's real purpose, to abuse criminal discovery to try this case in the media rather than in court." The DOJ complaint against Bannon went on to explain that almost immediately after his arrest, Bannon assembled a de facto press conference and that he was using his popular image to politicize the proceedings, especially when he said that he would make the charges against him, quote, "the misdemeanor from hell for Merrick Garland, Nancy Pelosi, and Joe Biden," unquote. Those familiar with Bannon's work would know that this isn't surprising in the slightest. Instead, it's expected for Bannon, who rides on controversy and discord. But what it does mean is that Bannon is having to fight for himself in a way that he hasn't before. Namely, that he is facing charges and consequences for his years of lying, manipulation, and other fanatical tendencies. To Bannon, it doesn't matter that Biden didn't order or influence the committee's decisions. It doesn't matter that he was involved with planning the rallies, or that he spent years helping propagate lies for the far right. To Bannon, this is about avoiding consequences. And it is good to see that the DOJ is taking action to point that out, though this should have been said from the beginning. Still, if there's to be any chance at holding Bannon accountable for his actions, they need to grin and bear his nonsense, if only to ask the court to dismiss his request until they can get a ruling, preferably with a guilty verdict. Alright, ladies and gentlemen, we will be right back after this break. Don't go anywhere. Lauren Boebert is facing a backlash after comments she made referring to Representative Ilhan Omar as the member of the Jihad Squad have come back to bite her in the rear. The story Boebert spun was that one of her staffers raced to her in the elevator when Ilhan Omar walked towards them, with her using the prejudice phrase to refer to the congresswoman. Nor is it the first time she has used this kind of prejudice commentary. She has made multiple comments to make it appear that Omar is just dangerous for being Muslim. Leaked audio and video shows that she repeated the phrase in a dinner with donors who seemed delighted that Boebert was engaging in Islamophobia.
One of my staffers, on his first day with me, got into an elevator in the Capitol. And in that elevator, we were joined by Ilhan Omar. Well, it was just us three in there, and I looked over and I said, "Well, look at there, it's the Jihad Squad."
In response to the controversy, Boebert did what she almost never does. She released an apology tweet, although it was only partial and addressed to the Muslim community and not Omar directly. Democratic House leaders, including Nancy Pelosi, were not so impressed with this apology. Pelosi said, quote, "Racism and bigotry of any form, including Islamophobia, must always be called out, confronted, and condemned in any place it is found," unquote. Instead of directly apologizing to Omar herself, Boebert called Omar and asserted that she did not intend to insult anyone's religion. Again, she's never acknowledging that she wronged Omar or in any way, shape, or form was actively engaging in harmful rhetoric. Instead, she's basically insisting that this was a misunderstanding. However, Omar correctly pointed out that Boebert should apologize to her directly and publicly, admitting she was wrong. Instead, Boebert decided to go on the attack, claiming that Omar had to apologize for her rhetoric, even though, unlike Boebert, Omar has apologized for some of the mistakes she has made. Instead, Omar did the right thing and hung up on her. And to be clear, there is a strong difference between Ilhan Omar, who has actively worked to improve her advocacy so as to actually avoid hurting the people that her rhetoric may offend in the past, versus, say, Boebert, who can't even be bothered to name the person she offended in her own apology. Instead, it's general platitudes about the Muslim community that she offended, instead of the actual person she's targeting and who is receiving death threats to this day. This is the kind of thing we keep seeing with the Republican Party and its rhetoric. There's a complete lack of responsibility, and there's a complete lack of consequences from the leadership. First, we had Marjorie Taylor Greene with her 9/11 denialism and Jewish space laser conspiracy theories. Then we had Paul Gosar making animations of himself killing his colleagues. And now we have open bigotry from a member of the United States House of Representatives. This is a sickness within the Republican Party. The continued nonsense that comes from the GOP has to stop. And if that is the foot Republicans intend to put forward before the midterms, then they are really revealing what they think about the American people. With the midterm elections coming up, we can only hope that our country proves that they are, in fact, wrong about who we are as a country. But that really depends on pushing back on people like Boebert. So when somebody says elections don't matter or things like that, remember, this is the nonsense we're up against. They, in the Republican Party, particularly Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene as well, think America is full of bigots, and they are willing to appeal to that bigotry to win. So if you really want to prove to the world, for some of my conservative friends, that America isn't a bigoted country or that it doesn't have a racist bone in its body, you should reject this. You should push back against this, and you should challenge your colleagues whenever you see them supported, or even just try to avoid the issue. This is a staple of the Republican Party, and it's going to be a stain on our country if we don't root it out soon. After years of control over one of the largest social media organizations in the world, Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, is stepping down. In a statement, Dorsey wrote, "I've decided to leave Twitter because I believe the company is ready to move on from its founders. My trust in Parag as Twitter CEO is deep. His work over the past 10 years has been transformational. I'm deeply grateful for his skill, heart, and soul. It is time to let him lead." This statement, while seemingly sincere, hides the intense hostility that existed among Twitter shareholders about Dorsey's leadership. Perhaps best demonstrating this, Twitter's stock went up by 11% after Dorsey announced his departure from the company. Additionally, Dorsey's management has been a matter of intense criticism due to his failure to adequately manage the platform in the face of harassment and manipulative accounts on the site. To add to that, Dorsey has been rightly criticized for failing to address the rise of the far right on his site. To this day, far right neo-Nazi Richard Spencer maintains an active account on the site, as does David Duke and other neo-Nazi propagandists. Dorsey also struggled to deal with leaders like Donald Trump appealing to those same propagandists, as his tweeting continued for 4 years straight, despite violating Twitter's terms of service multiple times. Even before he was president, Donald Trump repeatedly made comments that violated Twitter's TOS. This suggests that, at least in my opinion, Twitter repeatedly failed to acknowledge that it had a problem with moderating its own systems, systems that it created. And that's fundamentally the problem with Dorsey's legacy. His was a position of continued negligence and an inability to do the most basic things when they had to be done. And, unfortunately, he waited to the bare end of Donald Trump's administration to actually ban him and enforce the rules to show that on websites like this, everybody is equal. Instead, he took the opportunity when it was presented to him, not when it was necessary to take action in the first place. It's unclear what will happen when it comes to Dorsey's departure or how his successor will handle this. But the fact that Dorsey's leaving is at the very least a chance to see some reform and changes within Twitter's operations. And I hope that this departure is evidence that Twitter will actually be more active in moderating its platform and doing so on a more consistent basis, applying the rules as they are meant to be applied, not just throwing random bans around or failing to authenticate accounts that have already gone through the process, but actually going after figures who violate the terms of service and harass people who are just trying to use their platform as a means to communicate with their fellow human beings. As many of you are no doubt aware, there is a new COVID variant spreading around the world. Known as the Omicron variant, this form of COVID-19 has increased concerns as we head into this month, as more people continue to go inside for the winter. The variant, which may be more infectious and is seemingly spreading rapidly, has created some cause for concern among officials, with the CDC encouraging all American adults to get a COVID-19 booster shot. That said, the Biden administration emphasized caution and restraint in a speech explaining how he was responding to the virus. More specifically, Biden emphasized that travel bans on South Africa alone were not going to stop the virus, and that we were all going to need to respond accordingly to this new variant.
The very day the World Health Organization identified the new variant, I took immediate steps to restrict travel from countries in Southern Africa. But while we have that travel restrictions can slow the speed of Omicron, it cannot prevent it. But here's what it does. It gives us time. Gives us time to take more actions, to move quicker, to make sure people understand You have to get your vaccine.
Part of the issue with this variant is that it appears it is more infectious than previous variants such as Delta, but scientists are still parsing together information about what it actually does. What is of major concern to them is that this virus may be more infectious due to the mutations on its spike protein. When a virus has mutations on its spike protein, it can increase its ability to infiltrate human cells, making it harder to avoid an infection. Omicron, as it stands right now, has at least 30 mutations, more than any other variant before it. Still, scientists are working to improve protections and even possibly to prepare a further vaccination program for this variant. What matters now is that we are all going to have to be cautious but aware about our current circumstances. We also have to recognize that this is not a doomsday scenario. I know that it feels a lot like that every time we hear a new variant has popped up or that there's a rise in infections. But the thing about this pandemic is that we can and should respond to it. We as a people have struggled throughout the last year and a half dealing with this pandemic and coming to terms with our own control over our own circumstances. And while we can't just individually snap our fingers and make the virus go away, we can respond in our own lives. If you do not currently have a booster shot and are eligible, you should go find it and get it. You should go to wherever it is available to you and get it as soon as possible. We as a society need to learn to change the things we can and accept the things we can't. We can't change right now that we don't have a lot of information. That's up to scientific professionals who will be examining this. But please listen to the CDC's advice and stay safe for your own sake and for your country. If we want to ever get out of this, we're going to actually have to listen and work together to fight against this variant. For our final story of the day, we turn to Chris Cuomo, who has officially been suspended from CNN. His suspension comes after new documents revealed that he was more involved in his brother's attempts to silence his accusers than he previously admitted. These revelations come from the New York Attorney General's office of Letitia James, who has also been investigating Cuomo's brother, the former governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo. According to these documents, Chris Cuomo actively went out of his way to use his journalistic connections to track down, monitor, and find anything he could on his brother's accusers, even going so far as to monitor the journalistic progress of Ronan Farrow, focusing on anything he wrote about his brother's business and the scandal surrounding his conduct. Needless to say, this is a massive violation of the public trust, as a journalist who is supposed to be serving the public is instead using his skills to protect a powerful politician, his own brother. Now, I understand that there are some who are reticent to see Chris Cuomo go, but the fact of the matter is Chris Cuomo is one of the weakest links at CNN that there possibly could be. This man has a habit of throwing away journalistic integrity for his familial connections. And I know there are going to be even more people who say, well, who wouldn't want to protect their brother? But when it comes to something as severe as, you know, sexual harassment and assault in some cases, there's no way that you can make that argument. Chris Cuomo has consistently shown that he's willing to put his familial ties into play. It was evident from the very beginning when he interviewed his own brother, didn't seem to see any ethical quandary with it, and then continued to play it off. Not only that, but the moment it was revealed that Chris Cuomo himself had a sexual harassment allegation against him, he should have been removed. I'm glad to see that CNN's finally taking a stand, but I wrote about this twice, and I was able to make up my mind, and I'm not even involved in CNN. The fact that someone actually had something to lose and still let this guy remain in a position of authority and on the air, no less, is an indictment on CNN's credibility. And I hope and pray, frankly, that CNN will stick with its guns and instead of just suspending Chris Cuomo, they will fire him as an example to any and all reporters who even think of doing what he did. Reporters, by their nature, are supposed to try to be as objective as humanly possible, not just trying to hide behind their familial ties. I understand that not all examples of journalists are 100% objective, but at the very least, using your connections should not be allowed in a major news organization. If there is to be any respect for the press going forward, people like Chris Cuomo need to be removed from the profession permanently. That's all for this week's episode. Thank you all for joining me. If you enjoyed the episode, feel free to share it online or with your friends and family. If you want to see more content outside of the podcast, consider checking out the new website. You can find it at progressive-american.com. There you can find this podcast and all of its episodes, my YouTube channel, and my newsletter, where I just discuss the Chris Cuomo scandal in even greater detail. Thanks again for listening, and have a wonderful day.